Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
It is incumbent upon all of us not to announce mission accomplished, not to put down our guard, but to continue that vigilance that got us where we are today, the lowest case rates, positivity rates, that is, in America. We are seeing bright light at the end of the tunnel. And on June 15th, all things being equal, we continue that good work. We'll have moved beyond that blueprint, and we'll be opening up this economy at business as usual.
Governor Gavin Newsom today detailing his plan to fully reopen California in about 2 months from now, June 15th. The state's color tier system for counties will end. The mask mandate will still be in place. And all of this, though, depends on enough people getting vaccinated, keeping case rates low and hospitalizations low. In other parts of the country, though, those numbers are going up. And COVID variants make up a growing share of those cases. The highly infectious UK variant has now been found in all 50 states. And some new research shows that school-aged children are playing a large role in that spread and are also coming down with more severe infections. Here to discuss the changing relationship between children and COVID-19 is Dr. Lena Wen. She's an emergency room physician and professor of public health at George Washington University. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, we are seeing big spikes in the Midwest and the Northeast, including increased transmission of this UK variant among children. What can you tell us about how this variant acts and how it acts differently from COVID-19, the regular COVID-19?
Absolutely. So this variant, the B.1.1.7 variant that originated in the UK, has three distinctive characteristics that are important for us to talk about. One, and here's the good news, it appears that the vaccines that we have are very effective against this particular variant. So that's the good news. The less good news is that this B.1.1.7 variant appears to be more contagious and also more virulent than the normal wild-type strains. If something is more contagious, it means that the spread becomes potentially exponential. So something that's, say, 50% more contagious doesn't mean that we're going to get 50% more cases. We actually get exponentially more cases because of the spread. And because if something's more contagious, it also means that the activities that we thought were relatively safer before are now going to be higher risk because it's more transmissible. Then there are increasing studies that show that it's more virulent, meaning that it also causes more severe disease.
Mm. Okay. And when you say that activities that were previously considered relatively safe may not be now, what is an example of what you're talking about?
That means that before, let's say that you could be within 3 feet of someone and probably not become infected. Now, probably that's not the case anymore. Or individuals who were who may have engaged in relatively higher risk activities but got lucky and did not get infected in the past, there's a higher chance of becoming infected with the variant now. Still very important to keep in mind, though, that this variant is spread the same way as the wild-type coronavirus. And so it's not that somehow there's a new method of spread. And so the best thing that we can do still is to keep on wearing masks, keep on that 6-foot physical distancing, and whenever possible, avoiding crowded indoor gatherings.
All right. I want to play a clip of tape from Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's one of the nation's top infectious disease experts, and he directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And he spoke on Meet the Press over the weekend about the spread of this variant.
This B.1.1.7 variant is a brand new ballgame. In fact, right here in Minnesota, we're now seeing the other aspect of this B.1.1.7 variant that hasn't been talked much about, and that is the fact that it infects kids very readily. Unlike the previous strains of the virus, we didn't see children under eighth grade get infected often, or they were not frequently very ill. They didn't transmit to the rest of the community. That's why I was one of those people very strongly supporting reopening in-class learning. B.1.1.7 turns that on its head.
So he seems to be questioning this idea that it's a good idea to get kids back in the classroom. And we did have CDC recommendations that they be spaced only 3 feet apart. Is he right to be questioning that and questioning that guidance?
Well, I agree with Dr. Osterholm in some respects in that we do need to really be watchful for this B117 variant. We also have to consider why it is that it appears that children are constituting a greater proportion of COVID-19 cases. Part of it is actually the good news, which is that older people are now increasingly vaccinated. We know that 80% of those who died in the pandemic are people over 65. In this age group, more than half are now fully vaccinated, over 75% have received at least one dose of the vaccine. And so you are going to see younger people become the driver of coronavirus spread. And unfortunately, younger people constituting a greater number of people who become severely ill because they're the ones who are not yet vaccinated. Also, schools are back. And actually, in many places, we're seeing that it's youth sports and extracurricular activities that are driving the spread, not actually what happens in the school, but what happens outside of school, in play dates, in birthday parties, in informal settings. And so I would say it's correct that we should be much more careful about spread, including in children. But I would not say that we should be closing schools at this point. Rather, I would say we need to look at schools as being essential. And if they are indeed essential, then we should do everything possible to keep schools open, improve the ventilation, make sure that teachers and staff are vaccinated, as an example, increase testing in schools, while also cutting down those other extracurricular activities that are actually fueling the spread.
So maybe we should reconsider extracurricular activities, maybe not have the celebratory pizza party after the soccer win, that kind of thing?
Exactly, because we should be looking at, use the science, and looking at what are those activities that are the highest risk. And the highest risk activities are not kids in school wearing masks, especially if they're in pods where there is better ventilation. Those are very low risk for transmission. But it's after school sports where kids may be letting down their guard. And as you mentioned, if there are pizza parties that people are eating with one another, that's where the transmission is occurring. And so we really need to be looking at our priorities as a society. And if the priority is, as I believe it should be, making sure that schools stay open for in-person instruction, then we should be reducing the risk in all other aspects of our lives.
When you say this strain is more virulent, is it more virulent in children? Because previously, children would be either asymptomatic if they got COVID or exhibit, in general, mild symptoms. Of course, there were kids who had severe symptoms, and also there have been children who have died of COVID. But in general, kids seem to get it much less severely than adults. Is it different with the variant?
Well, you're right that in general, children tend to become much less severely ill than adults do, although some children, even with the wild type strain, have sadly become very ill, have required hospitalization, and hundreds of children have died from COVID-19. With B117, in adults, and therefore also probably in children, it does seem to cause more severe disease. Certainly in adults, there is a higher rate of hospitalizations and a higher rate of deaths. That's not even taking into account that when you have something that's more contagious, you are going to see more cases. Therefore, you're going to see more deaths. But actually, in and of itself, it appears to be more virulent in adults. This probably also applies for children as well.
Currently, children under the age of 16 are not eligible to be vaccinated, but Pfizer did release at least a press release stating that in its trials, it is 100% effective in protecting against symptomatic disease in children aged 12 to 15. When do you expect it to be approved for the use in younger kids?
Yeah, the best estimates that we have we hope at least that for children ages 12 and older, that there will be a vaccine approved for their use by end of summer, early fall, ideally before the beginning of the next school year, which is really important because we know that older kids tend to spread coronavirus with the same patterns as adults. Younger children seem to spread it less. Older children probably spread it more. And so by vaccinating older children and teens, that allows for safer return to school in that age group. Probably for younger age groups, children under 12, it may not be until the end of 2021 or even probably into 2022 that a vaccine is going to be available for that younger age group. Again, this is something that I'm watching very carefully myself as the mother of a one-year-old and a three-and-a-half-year-old. I am very eager to have my children be vaccinated so that they can also be protected from COVID-19. And also because if we don't have children vaccinated, it's going to be hard for us to reach herd immunity. Given the number of children that there are, I do think that it's important for us to try to get children vaccinated as soon as possible.
Dr. Lena Wen, ER physician and professor of public health at George Washington University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, despite concern over variants and possible fourth waves of cases, the vaccine rollout in the United States is going pretty well. About 40% of the adult population has gotten at least one dose. And that means there is just as many people carrying around those white cards from the CDC showing proof that they got their shots. These same white cards could become our tickets to getting back to normal activities like going to concerts or traveling internationally. It's the closest thing we have in the U.S. to an actual vaccine passport, so health officials are urging us to take good care of them. Well, here to tell us how to do that is Maureen Miller, infectious disease epidemiologist at Columbia University. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, tell us about this card. What's on it and what does it do?
The card is your certification that you have been vaccinated. It includes the information of which vaccine you got, for example, Pfizer. It includes the serial number of the vial from which your vaccine came, and your name, your birth date, where you got it, the date you got it, and that's it. That's all it really needs to have on it to verify that you had the vaccine and not give away additional information.
Still, there's a lot of sensitive information on there, so maybe you shouldn't photograph it and put it on social media.
I think that's very unwise to do. I'm pretty surprised that people are doing it because it is a very counterfeitable document. And if you show examples of what the information for each vial looks like, anybody can make up any kinds of information. They can even copy your card and just change the name. So photographing it front and back for your own records, that is recommended. Putting it on social media, not smart.
No, not smart at all. And there are stories already of counterfeit cards making the rounds. So what should we be doing? Let's say we get both doses. We are fully vaccinated. What should we do with this card?
This is a really important document. And right now, it's the most accessible document to each individual who gets vaccinated. Put it in a very safe place. You don't have to carry it around with you because there's no standardization. There's no guidance as to when you're going to need it, how you're going to need it. And really the first times that you're likely to need it is through international travel. Although that said, two universities in the United States, Cornell and Rutgers, are mandating that their students be fully vaccinated before they return to school in the fall.
So they'll have to show their cards?
As with everything, it's evolving so quickly because they are so counterfeitable that, we're working, lots of different people are working on creating wheels that are the digitized version of the certificate.
Right. And some places have already digitized your vaccine record. Private companies
yes.
have done that.
Private companies have done that. The World Health Organization has had a vaccine record certificate that has been recognized around the world since the WHO came into existence, and it's called the Yellow Card. It was originally used for as a notification that you had been vaccinated against yellow fever. So The card itself is yellow. The initial use was for yellow fever. And then they added cholera. And now it is a digitized and in paper form. There's two different versions available where they include exactly that same information, where you were vaccinated, the dose, the explicit dose serial number, and who did it and when. So that is recognized worldwide. And like many organizations who've worked at digitizing, they didn't really start doing anything till December. It's like we knew last January that this was going to be an issue, but you know, people were just crazy and involved in other things. So they have the guiding principles, and they are working right now on trying to take their place globally as the certificate of choice.
Do you think the United States would sign on to that, or would the U.S. go its own way, as it often does in these matters, and create its own digital passport?
They, you know, there's no real signing on to it because I always had a yellow card. I have a vaccine certificate from the WHO right now. The U.S. doesn't have to agree to it, but it is a document that's recognized globally. The challenge that we have right here is that, you know, IBM has one, that, you know, New York State has one, different business organizations that I've discussed with, that they want their own. But who's going to recognize each of these different vaccine certificates? They're digitized, but how do you verify that that's a real document? So until there's some kind of guidance, and it's probably going to have to be the CDC making rules around what can be recognized, or even lists of what can be recognized. It's just a real mess of a system that I think will evolve, and probably by the fall we'll have some sort of system in place where it won't be as important that you have your paper card that you have right now. But until that moment, that is a very valuable card.
Right. So until that moment, we should take care of it, protect it. A lot of people are laminating their cards, and Staples and Office Depot are offering to laminate these cards for free. Is that a good idea, to laminate?
I'm certainly getting mine laminated just so that nobody, if heaven forbid I lose it, nobody can then alter it. You know, you have to pull it out of the laminate, whatever. So I am going to laminate mine just as a protected document, because honestly, by the time something like boosters, which we will probably have to have in future, but by the time they are developed, approved, and needed, that probably won't be till the beginning of next year of 2022. So the system will have worked itself out. So, because I know people, that's the big question. Well, what about the boosters? I won't be able to put it on this document. We will have another system in place. I'm almost certain of it. Too many people are working on the issue.
Well, hopefully. Then in the meantime, hopefully. Well, fingers crossed with everything. And in the meantime, if you lose it, you can maybe get another card or replacement from your state health department.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or because we've included pharmacies in the distribution, I think what we've done in this country is pretty darn amazing. But you can go directly to the pharmacy group where you received your vaccine. You know, if you got it at a CVS, for example, you can go to any CVS and say, I lost my card. You're going to have identification, certainly, but they will be able to replace that information.
All right. Maureen Miller, infectious disease epidemiologist at Columbia University. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the June 15th reopening date the governor set today may go a long way toward blunting the recall attempt against him, but there is recall fever sweeping California. Other elected officials are facing an angry electorate. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Californians have a fever. Recall fever. We've talked several times on this show about the drive to replace Gavin Newsom, and we will likely do that again. But recall fever goes way beyond just the governor. There are pushes to oust the district attorneys in both San Francisco and Los Angeles. The same is true for the mayor of Sacramento, members of the San Francisco School Board, even Shasta County supervisors. What is happening? We're going to ask Jeremy White, who covers California politics for Politico. Hi.
Hey there.
Well, what is this fever that seems to be sweeping California?
I think it should come as no surprise to your listeners that there is a lot of frustration out there and disillusionment, I think, with government at all levels, whether that's a business owner who's angry at Gavin Newsom over restrictions, parents who are frustrated that their school board hasn't managed to get kids back in school, folks in Sacramento who believe the mayor has failed the homeless population there. So these are not all directly caused by the pandemic, but I think that is sort of the irreducible atmosphere that is really driving a lot of the discontent out there.
And it's on all sides, right? Liberals and conservatives?
One thing I have been struck by is particularly on the schools issue, speaking to parents in liberal enclaves like Berkeley and San Francisco, who are just fed up and who have told me things like it's a failure of democracy. So certainly in some cases, for example, the effort to recall Gavin Newsom, I think it's driven predominantly by conservatives who probably weren't fans in the first place. But I think there are certainly signs out there that some of the frustration and desire to hold government accountable is crossing party lines here.
Right. So you mentioned parents in Berkeley and San Francisco. They are particularly frustrated about the slow pace of school reopenings. Is that the general frustration there?
I think it's not just the slow pace, but in San Francisco in particular, I think parents are really fed up with what they see as their school board being preoccupied with renaming schools. There was this marathon school board meeting where they spent hours debating if a parent should be on a sort of volunteer advisory committee. So the San Francisco School Board has since sort of put a pause on the school renaming and has devoted more sort of explicit public time to talking about reopening schools. So they're trying to get on the right track. But I think it's not just the fact that schools are closed. It's this perception that it's not even a priority.
Right. Well, I mean, recalls are meant to get rid of politicians who have committed a grievous error slash crime slash unethical behavior. They're not meant to be used just because voters are angry.
That's correct to a point, but I would note that there is not a bar for recalls that, you know, this elected official has to have committed a crime. It's a little bit like impeachment, where it's in ways it's more of a political standard than a legal one. I would say when it comes to the recall of Governor Newsom, for example, a lot of his defenders have said this is a waste of time. This doesn't meet what should be a very high bar for a recall. Some of them have even gone so far as to label it anti-democratic or a coup. But there was some polling out last week from the Public Policy Institute of California, a very respected organization, that found a majority of voters actually believe the attempted recall of the governor is an appropriate use of the process. So there are certainly objections you can make on a sort of democratic level of, is this a waste of time? But, you know, voters are attempting to use some of the powers given to them by the California Constitution.
And basically any elected official can be recalled?
Yes. The rules kind of vary, but yes.
Okay. And so that includes the mayor of Sacramento, Daryl Steinberg. You alluded to his troubles. Apparently people are angry about his action or inaction when it came to the homeless population there.
That's right. Sacramento, like many cities in California, has been struggling to get more homeless people housed. There was a pretty severe winter storm, and people died after warming centers were not opened by the city. A lot of activists there blaming Mayor Steinberg for that and saying that he's really lost the confidence of his populace.
What about the move to recall these progressive DAs in Los Angeles and San Francisco? George Gascon here in LA, and up in San Francisco, the DA there, Chesa Boudin. Are those serious recall attempts?
I think they are fairly serious, and I think one way that you can gauge the seriousness of them is in San Francisco, for example, money is flowing to protect Chesa Boudin from some of the sort of big donors to progressive prosecutors that helped support his election and George Gascon's election in Los Angeles. You know, both of these district attorneys ran on a reform platform, and I don't think anybody expected that it would be a smooth course and that they wouldn't encounter resistance from law enforcement interests, and we've certainly seen that. I think the scale of it has maybe been surprising. In Los Angeles, for example, George Gascon faced a lawsuit from his own line attorneys trying to push back on some of his planned reforms, which was then supported by the State California District Attorneys Association. So seeing some law enforcement resistance to changes, not unexpected, but I think the sort of public scope of it and the extent to which we've really seen a lot of older guard unify against their directives, that is something that I really has put us in a pretty extraordinary place.
And do you think we would be seeing all these recall attempts if it weren't for the big kahuna recall attempt against Gavin Newsom?
That's a great question. It's a question I put to everyone I spoke to. Quite a few of them said, no, we're independent from the Newsom recall effort. But I also spoke to an expert on recall elections who noted that the pace of recall attempts, both in California and nationally, has really picked up in recent decades. And this scholar attributed that in part to the increasing visibility of the Gray Davis recall here in California in 2003, the attempted recall of Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin. And sort of the more people see these recall attempts, the more they say, huh, maybe I could try something like that. Whether people are specifically motivated by the Newsom recall itself is a little harder to tease out, but there certainly seems to be evidence that there is just increasing interest that's sort of self-sustaining in the recall system as a way to remove people from power.
All right. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Jeremy White. He covers California politics for Politico. Coming up, how women created some of TV's lasting formats like the sitcom and the live talk show. Hazel Scott was the first Black host of a national primetime television show.
She is beautiful, and all she has to do is look into the camera and say, hello, my name is Hazel Scott, and you are riveted.
The little-known female pioneers in TV. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for TV on the Radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yes.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offer before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Well, every Tuesday we talk about TV, and really, TV is dominated by men. Most of the shows are created by men, written by men, directed by men. The history of television is dominated by men. The big names from radio took their popularity to a new medium when TV was created. And you know those names, Milton Berle, Ed Sullivan, Jackie Gleason. Overlooked? The women who pioneered TV. And yes, there were many. A new book called When Women Invented Television argues that four women in particular were behind some key TV formats. Erna Phillips created the soap opera. Gertrude Berg created one of the first sitcoms. Hazel Scott was the first Black primetime television host. And Betty White, yes, that Betty White, well, she helped create the daytime talk show. Jennifer Cation Armstrong is the author of When Women Invented Television. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when you think of pioneering women in television, often Lucille Ball comes to mind when talking about the early days of television. But how did you realize that there were more than one woman, that there were many women, in fact, that had been key in the early days of television?
Well, there was sort of a specific kind of route that I ended up taking to get there. But, you know, you bring up Lucille Ball, and that was a huge part of it, is that you know, I knew about her, obviously. And it was always presented as like, isn't this amazing that this one woman did this? Which is true. It is. It's incredible. But what started to happen is I was doing some research for my book about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted. And I tripped on some of these strands of history, like the fact that the creators of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, James L. Brooks and Alan Burns, brought up a woman named Gertrude Berg to me and mentioned her as one of the inspirations behind their character Rhoda, who's Mary's best friend and is a Jewish New Yorker. And I thought, I've never heard of this woman, you know, and I looked it up and it turned out she was huge in the late 40s and early 50s, had the first successful family sitcom. It was so successful, it became a movie. It had come from radio and went to TV and was so successful, it went back to radio. She had a line of house dresses. Like, you know, we're talking, she was a big deal and I didn't know anything about her. And I thought, wow, she predates Lucy. What else is back here, kind of? Mm-hmm. And as I started to look into it, it turned out there were a bunch of women doing things. And it was sort of shocking. And that was kind of how I ended up coming to this as a topic.
Right. So Gertrude Berg, I think you cite one public opinion poll back in the 40s that said she was the second most popular woman in America after Eleanor Roosevelt. So she was kind of like Oprah, I guess.
Yeah.
But and yet exactly. We do not know her name. I had never heard of her before reading your book. Why is that? Why do we know Lucille Ball and we don't know Gertrude Berg?
Well, there are a number of reasons that seem pretty clear to me. You know, they're still guesses, but it's fairly clear. One of which is Gertrude's show came on the air in 49 when it was still all television was live. And so the very earliest episodes, which are some of my favorites, were not very well preserved. They, you know, it was shown live and the only real copies they made at the time were what were called kinescopes, which to a very short version of that, they're like a movie of a movie. They would shoot a camera at the little screen monitor showing the live broadcast. And it's like almost like bootleggers at a movie theater, you know? So very poor quality versus Lucy coming out a few years later, they made a very fateful decision to shoot that on film. And that turns out to be the big key is that we can still watch that on our streaming services now. And it looks okay. It looks good. Mm-hmm. The other big thing is that Gertrude Berg kind of runs into the Hollywood blacklist in 1950, and her TV husband, Philip Loeb, was blacklisted.
Interesting. Her show, The Goldbergs, this was one of the first sitcoms?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there were a number of shows that could kind of qualify for that at the time, of course, but she also really pioneered the form on radio. She had been on the radio for 17 years with the show The Goldbergs, which we can recognize as a family sitcom now, right? It's, you know, a family facing down usually pretty sweet little problems together. Mom usually saves the day, played by Gertrude Berg, Molly Goldberg, you know, and it's just the little, like exactly what we think of. And then when she brought it to television, it really does look like what we think of as a family sitcom now.
She also was one of the first to have product placement. I just want to play a clip of tape of her talking about the decaf coffee,
yes,
known as Sanka.
I don't know how it is with you, but I know how it is with me. You know, and I'm not saying, you know, that vacations are not good and they're not necessary, but I don't know. I can't get myself back into the routine to retune myself. And, you know, if it wasn't for Sanka, I don't know, I would be a wreck of my former self. At least with Sanka, I'm sure of a good night's sleep. If not, I don't know, I would be so irritable, nobody could talk to me.
So she's talking directly to the camera, and just as a, you know, to set the scene, she's playing the matriarch, Mrs. Goldberg, who is a, you know, middle class, lower middle class, matriarch of a Jewish family living in a tenement in the Bronx. And she was incredibly likable. Everyone loved her, right?
Absolutely. And I got to tell you, I think it comes through even in the audio, but watching some of these commercial spots, which, yeah, was a huge deal. Like she was kind of the first to do commercial spots in character that she wrote herself to be in that voice, and you can hear it, right? They are so compelling. Like you want to go get Sanka coffee whenever she talks to you about it, because you're like, my God, this woman, she's just, you want to do what she tells you to do. And one of the critics even said something to the effect of, we are all children when Gertrude Berg is on the screen.
Let's talk about someone else who is incredibly likable and compelling. And that is, of course, Betty White. And everybody loves Betty White. And but we know her from The Mary Tyler Moore Show and from Golden Girls, of course. But she was an early pioneer. She hosted a daily talk show called Hollywood on Television, where she would be on air for more than 5 hours a day unscripted. And here she is on another talk show describing what that was like.
It was a joyous experience. It was like going to college to learn television, because everything that could possibly happen happened on camera.
But what was the 5.5-hour-a-day show?
It was a variety guest interview type show on the old KLAC station in Los Angeles. It was either The Test Pattern or Us. And some of the people like The Test Pattern.
So that's an interview from 1964. Tell us about that show and how she helped create it.
You know, they didn't know what to do in daytime. When they first started really getting going with television, you know, they were kind of doing primetime first, but they realized they had all day. I always say, you know, their answer at KLAC in Los Angeles was Betty White. Just put her on. And her co-host, who was a DJ named Al Jarvis, were just on there for 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week, improvising. They had no writers. They would come up with a few ideas while they were doing their own hair and makeup, because it was, you know, low budget in those days. They would just kind of figure it out. They would do sketches. They would talk about the news. They would talk about music. They would have some guests, you know, and I think it really explains a lot about Betty White's enduring appeal. Like, she is still so quick-witted. She's great in front of a camera. You know, she had 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week practice for the beginning of her career. So of course she's great at that.
Right. And then she had her own talk show, and then she had her own sitcom. During all of that time, this was in the 40s and 50s, I should say the late 40s, early 50s, she was not married. She decided to devote herself to her career. And I guess that was a controversial decision back then.
Yeah, absolutely. She had actually been married twice already. And she was asked constantly in interviews why she wasn't married, why she didn't have children. And she sort of sweetly and calmly explained, just like, oh, you know, I can't do a husband justice, is the way she would sort of say it, without giving up my career right now. So I'm going to focus on my career.
Wow. Well, another woman who also chose her career and had two kids she adopted is the woman you say basically created soap operas. Her name was Erna Phillips. Tell us how she came up with this idea to create soap operas for women, housewives, I guess, who stayed at home.
Yeah, she was actually told by her boss in radio to create something that women would like so they could sell them products. And actually, in the early days, it was kind of revolutionary, maybe without even fully realizing it. They were all women. It was all female characters. And this was easy to, you know, record, because she could do some of the voices and then she'd have like one other actress doing some of the voices. They would often take place in a boarding house and it would just be women having conversations about their lives. She is responsible for organ cues, organ music cues being the way we think of like the dramatic moment. She was sorry about that, by the way. She wants you all to know that.
Really?
She was later in life. She was like, I know that's really annoying. I'm sorry. I didn't know it was going to stick. And loved a cliffhanger to bring her audience back every single day.
We actually have that a clip of the organ, and I just want to play it since you mentioned it.
And now, the guiding light, created by Erna Phillips.
I can see why she apologized for the organ. But she is the queen of soaps, the guiding light, the second longest running drama in American history. Why aren't more people familiar with her name?
I think in her case, it really is because she was only behind the scenes. Once she transitioned the soap operas from radio to television, she was not in front of the camera the way she was, you know, in front of the microphone in her early days of radio. She had also become kind of a mogul by that time. I think of her as kind of the Shonda Rhimes of her day. She had many shows on the air. she was always kind of juggling that. She ran it all from Chicago. She didn't like either coast. She tried it. She didn't like it. So she would fly in to New York to supervise her shows. But then she would, you know, work from home in Chicago. But she really toiled behind the scenes. And I think that that's why she's not a household name.
Well, someone else who really should have been a household name or should be a household name today is Hazel Scott. She was this incredible virtuoso on the piano and launched the Hazel Scott Show in 1950. She was married to New York Congressman Adam Clayton Powell. They were an it couple, beautiful, wealthy, powerful. And so tell us how she got her own show back in 1950.
Yeah, she was, I say she was like the Beyonce of her day. You know, she was touring the country as a jazz musician. People loved her. She had two big tricks. She could play two pianos at once. She did something called swinging the classics, where she would start out playing, you know, a Bach song the way you expect it to be. And by the end, would have jazzed it all up to make it super cool and of the moment. And she was very, very famous, and even more so, like you said, because she was married to Adam Clayton Powell Jr., and they were very politically active and would kind of use her platform as an artist to advance civil rights. So she would not play segregated venues, and if she walked in and saw that one was, she'd walk back out, and then she'd give a bunch of interviews about it and talk about how she couldn't believe that someone would pay to see someone who looked like her and not want to sit next to someone who looked like her. And, you know, she's kind of at the heights of all of this when television was coming into its own in 1950. And there was a fourth network named Dumont, along with ABC, CBS, and NBC at the time. And those fourth startup networks often are pretty feisty. So they really wanted to make a splash, and they went to Hazel Scott for that. She was very good at that and incredibly watchable on the screen. She was beautiful. And all she has to do is look into the camera and say, hello, my name is Hazel Scott. And you are riveted. And they started her out a local show in New York one day a week. Eventually she became so popular, she got multiple nights and then went national. And this actually makes her the first Black person to have their own national primetime show.
But yet we don't remember that. We remember Nat King Cole.
Right. And a huge reason for this is that, well, there's two reasons really. Hazel's great run was really cut short, like Gertrude Berg's. She was doing great. Like all of the reviews I read at the time were saying, we want more of her on television. And toward the end of the year, she ends up on the same blacklist as Gertrude Berg's TV husband, Philip Loeb, was on. This kind of spins out of control quickly. She makes a play to actually clear her name. She decides to go before the House Un-American Activities Committee voluntarily. In fact, she demands to. They didn't want to see her. And she gives an incredible speech explaining why this is so wrong and goes back home satisfied with what she had done, which she should be. I mean, I think it's heroic. You know, you can imagine this is a panel of white men, one of whom had ties to the Ku Klux Klan, and she did it. And unfortunately, that movie does not end the way you want it to. She should have been rewarded for this, but instead, when she gets back home to New York, it slowly starts to fall apart and she loses her show. You know, I think if she had been allowed to stay on that trajectory until more people had television sets, TV really was not at its peak of, you know, kind of influence yet. It wasn't what it would become by 53, 54, 55. And if she had been able to stay on, I think she would have been seen as the Nat King Cole, as the first. Instead, by the time, it's just a few years later, and when Nat King Cole's show goes on the air, it's really seen as the breakthrough. And maybe it is because so many more people saw it.
All right. Well, let's go out on some Hazel Scott. Unfortunately, a lot of her clips of her television show did not survive, but this one piece went viral recently and it got like 10 million views. This is her from 1943. And so let's go out on that. Thank you so much for this fascinating history.
Thank you so much for talking to me about it.
My pleasure. That's Jennifer Cation Armstrong. Her book is called When Women Invented Television, The Untold Story of the Female Powerhouses Who Pioneered the Way We Watch Today. Coming up, why there's a ketchup shortage in America right now. Yes, ketchup. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Remember at the beginning of the pandemic when everyone was panic buying toilet paper and grocery stores couldn't keep up with the demand for bread, for paper towels, hand sanitizer? Well, thankfully that's over. But now it seems we're running low on, wait for it, Heinz ketchup. Restaurants can't have condiment bottles on the tables anymore. The CDC nixed that. And there's more takeout now. So that's translated into a big demand for those little packets. You know, the ones that used to linger in your office desk drawer. Well, Heinz was not prepared for that. Joining us to talk about the great ketchup shortage is Annie Gasparo from The Wall Street Journal. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, when did this ketchup crisis begin?
Well, we really started hearing about it last summer when people started to venture out a little bit from their houses, getting takeout and delivery, going through drive-thrus, and more restaurants opened up after having closed earlier in the pandemic. And it really created a run on these little packets. In the ketchup industry, they're called sachets.
Okay, that sounds so grand and yes. Classy. A sachet sounds like you'd want to sniff it rather than eat it. So Heinz basically didn't have enough of these sachets. They had all their ketchup in bottles.
Yeah, they obviously made the packets, they made squeeze bottles, all of that, and the demand just shifted to the single serving packets because of COVID, and the machines make those little packets, those little sachets, just couldn't keep up with demand. Everybody, you know, sit down restaurants, steakhouses, what have you, were looking for single serve packets. And those sort of establishments, you would normally have a bottle on the table. So it just shifted the demand so suddenly. Their machines couldn't keep up. So Heinz has been doing everything it can to try to meet this demand. But restaurants, especially now that more and more restaurants are reopening, especially for in-service, in restaurant dining, the restaurants are saying they're just, this is a ketchup calamity.
Nice alliteration, a ketchup calamity. Well, what about the other companies? There are other companies that make ketchup, not just Heinz.
Yeah, and Hunt's and some of the off brands have said that they are not having that much trouble. It's really Heinz because Heinz has such a big stake in the market. They're like around 70% market share for ketchup. So that really means that people, restaurants, consumers want Heinz specifically. So some of the restaurants we talked to said, we're thinking of the unthinkable. We're thinking of trying an alternative to Heinz. But in the past, they just never wanted to do that because it has such a strong brand loyalty.
I mean, would anyone really know, like, if the restaurant put some ketchup into a little dish, is anyone going to say, nope, I can tell that's not Heinz?
That is definitely something that we'll probably find out, right? Because restaurants are starting to do that because of short supply. They're going to Costco, they're buying alternative brands and putting them in little cups, little plastic ramekins for people to take home.
Well, so this whole thing happened because the CDC said you can't have condiment bottles on the table because yuck, all those people handling them. Is that going to be a thing of the past? Like, we'll no longer have condiments on the table?
It seems like that traditional glass bottle is the most problematic going forward because the CDC has since just recently said that the transfer of COVID on surfaces is incredibly rare. But with those glass bottles, you always have the people that stick their knife in the ketchup bottle to get out. Yeah. their ketchup, and that just is hard to imagine going forward, right?
Yeah. Not to mention the salt and pepper shakers, all of it, I guess.
But you're usually not sticking your finger or your knife in the salt or pepper shaker.
or licking it, hopefully.
Yeah.
So then will there be like is Heinz developing another kind of technology then than the old fashioned bottle?
Yes. They, amid the pandemic, came out with a touchless ketchup dispenser for restaurants, which is, you know, imagine those hand sanitizer dispensers. You just stick your hands in and it comes out. That's what it'll be. But ketchup, so you can stick your plate under there, or the restaurant can stick their little plastic cups under there. But that is something that Heinz is hoping will alleviate the packet shortage this year. And Heinz is also coming out with new production lines for these packets.
Yeah.
So they will increase their production later this year.
Annie Gasparo, food retail reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll see you tomorrow. Keeping me